Welcome in, kingly brothers and heroic husbands from around the planet. Welcome to a new episode of the Be the Husband She Brags About podcast. In today's episode, we welcome back in Four Arrows. Four Arrows is former director of education at Oglala Lakota College and currently a professor at Fielding Graduate University. Is the author of over 20 books about applications of our original nature-based worldview, including Restoring the Kinship Worldview. Four Arrows was selected by UC Berkeley's Science Center for the Greater Good as one of the most important of 2022. Four Arrows was selected by Aero as one of the 27 visionaries in education and is a recipient of the Martin Springer Institute Moral Courage Award for his activism. He lives with his wife of 40 years on the Costa Alegre in Mexico. Four Arrows, brother. It's an honor and a privilege to have you back in a second time, brothers.
I'm looking forward to it. And you know, I would really love to learn. Your audience probably knows this well, but I would love to know a little bit more about how you got started with this particular topic.
I'm definitely going to roll with that to bring it conversational. And what I would begin with is, this is what I love about elder energy. I want to start with that. There's this boldness and grounded authenticity that I have found coming, speaking with you the first time. And I had another beautiful elder in, Dewey Freeman, actually another profound man in horsemanship, etc. So maybe there's a common link there with nature, of course. But I love this grounded, fearless authenticity and a fearlessness to just be spontaneous and go with what feels right by you. How I got into this work. Four Arrows, I got into this work. I've spoke to the guys before, but just to bring it real and live with you, and maybe there's quite a few new guys to it. The shorter answer is about 3.5-4 years ago, I invited a man into our family home. I fell ill for 2 weeks, actually, just to nod and bow. I know you're coming out the far side of a flu, but I had a really bad flu/chest infection with a bad exacerbation of asthma. I think it was psychosomatic, you know, the exacerbation at that point when I had invited this other gentleman in. And 4 hours, what I can only say is, this man at that point in my life as a man, in my journey, I perceived him as being the man I was doomed never to be able to be like. He was, to my perspective in that time, I was awed by his emotionality, his sensuality, his sensitivity. He could speak with my wife, you know, in such an open-hearted way and hold space for pretty much anything she needed to speak to, and was so in tune with her emotionally and on so many topics, like pretty much any, what for me for the first 12 years of marriage up until that point was, you know, that I just didn't know how to enter those conversations, were sort of feminine oriented type conversations, and I probably was ignorant in that, but like there's so many different things that Matilda was into and healing journeys and tarot cards and different things like that I just did not know how to relate with any of that. And yet this man was. And what unfolded over that 2 weeks was a rapid closeness evolved and came between my beautiful queen and this gentleman, and a total distance of me. So it was like they were there flirting in front of me and getting closer and closer, and like all their body language and communication and like the depth of their conversations, etc. Sort of culminated with one evening. They had been going off to jiu-jitsu because I was sick. They were going off to jiu-jitsu, and they were having, you know, it's an hour drive to the training. They were having these deep conversations, and Matilda was coming back actually quite, you know, all inspired by these conversations and where this guy was bringing her into conversation. So I was on some level aware of oh my God, like what's happening here? My physical state wasn't allowing me the energy, and my psychological state, I didn't have the tools. But cut a long story short, I woke up on the first day of feeling better. I had like really, really sick for the first 2 weeks. And it was that first morning where, you know, I just had that like really like, it was like a 50, 60% increase of energy from the previous 2 weeks. I was on the heel. I was getting better. And the words came to my mind, which was, Mark, first thought that morning, 4 hours, was, Mark, you've got to step into kingship. Now, I was not into men's work at that time. So masculine, archetypal language, king, warrior, magician, lover, like that was not part of my vocabulary. So it was completely atypical language. It was like kingship was not like, it was not a word I had any relationship with up until that point. But obviously my intuition just knew what the inner guidance was at that time. And I walked down to the breakfast table, looked Matilda in the eyes, and for the first time, 4 hours, literally, I think in 12 years of marriage together, I owned a need. I was like, baby, I have a deep need to go talk with you. I need to go for a walk with you, and I need to talk with you. And we went, and literally that's the concise version of like how I got into this work. Literally, you know, stepping into kingship that morning, my intuition, it was like I showed up for the first time in my marriage. There was no blame on my queen. It was like she was feeling this closeness with this other man. I think I intuitively knew for the first time, it's like that was all on me, in the sense of, if you don't show up as a man, if you don't do the work, if you don't know what emotional attunement is about, you know, I never figured out a way to meet those needs. So I wasn't blaming her. For the first time in my life, in my adult life, I wasn't shaming myself. And I just said, hey, baby, I want to turn this around. I'm going to do whatever is necessary. But it's like, I love you. I'm going to figure out whatever I need to figure out as a man to make shit happen, that, you know, I can be emotional. The needs this dude is meeting for a couple of weeks. It's like, there was a bit of spikiness in me. It was like, it's fucking easy for him to come in on the turf. And there was other signs in his life that he was doing this regularly with women with no energetic boundaries. But that to the side, it was like, here, I'm here to fight for our marriage. And for the right to have my family together long term. And it's been about 3.5 or 4 years since 4 hours. And, you know, the Be the Husband She Brags About podcasts and movement and Heroic Husbands Men's Circles have birthed since then. But that's the most concise summary I can give to you to really just know, like, what was the cross of destiny in my life, and that led me to this path and movement, and ultimately this conversation with you today.
Wow. Well, I have to tell you, I am very moved by your sharing this, not just with me, but with your audience. I think it's actually, and you probably have already thought about this, but for me, it's actually an example of a shamanistic near-death experience that you actually experienced.
Can you take me deeper? I don't want to make any assumptions about what you're pointing to. And
you know, even during this past 2 weeks that I've had this type A flu, that because of my low immune system from the successful chemo, you know, really has had me down. I have felt the emotionality and vulnerability and insight of different things and different goals and what, you know, what life is about, and an illness like what you had, especially when you add asthma to it, because not breathing is much of a near death experience as I had in my own, you know, my own times on the river. And what we know about near death experiences is that they bring an awakening, a deep awakening of what is really real and what is really true and who you really are. And so I don't know if you had ever thought about that that illness as an example of it, but I, you know, I don't know of any Lakota or Kogi or any other spiritual leaders who had not themselves hit bottom one way or the other in terms of opening the windows to see what was really right and what was really appropriate for their lives. And almost all, in all cases, they moved into some form of healing, which of course your program does.
I'll give a little bit of context within the culture of guys listening in, and then just to give my personal meaning that you were asking towards. I love the context, you know, these tribe leaders and amazing members of these indigenous tribes, that their path to their awakening is coming through the path of pain, of like there's a suffering that comes upon them. Because I've been humbled, and it's such an honor to have an opening into guys' lives, you know, to jump on discovery calls with me. And it's an understatement to say that there's a lot of pain out there. But guys, I think, like myself, previous to that experience and the amount of work that has come to, and then meeting guys like you that, you know, that can give that sacred context. So often it's happening like within modern men and husbands is like that the pain and suffering in a marriage is like a sign of complete failure. Like they're a screw up as a man. And yet, you know, the sacred context that you're building in is like, hey, that's like there's a perfection in that pain. It's like, what's it pointing you towards? So it's a beautiful sacred context that I really hope guys listening in are settling, letting settle in their nervous systems. To speak to, you know, you asked me, it's like, did I ever think of it that way? Like an asthma and the near-death experience. Actually, a lot of my turnaround, you know, was like definitely a personal turnaround. You know, it's like I think I set out to save my marriage, but I realized I was like ultimately saving myself. You know, it was like the marriage was secondary. But breathwork was a real entry into that experience. And part of the breathwork exercise I was doing, to give you a bit of a context, how I landed in that sort of near-death experience in actually a very profound way. So it's interesting you bring it up. Part of one breathwork approach to overcoming asthma is true breath holding, that you do 100 step practice and you take one little breath, breathe it out, peg your nose, close your mouth, and start walking for 100 steps, and then you do breath holds. And it has a whole beautiful physiological reason why that comes about, why it brings about a cessation or a healing to asthma symptoms. But in that journey, 4 hours, definitely like in the beginning, I'm able to relax into it now. The act of voluntarily, you know, taking a small breath, breathing out, pegging my nose and going walking, and the discipline and the training was that, you know, to not panic. And I had to learn to relax into these massive waves of fear that were coming up, and anxiety and rage that were coming up, that the practice was bringing out all of the most troubling emotions that I had repressed and suppressed for like literally an entire lifetime. So but there were definite moments when I thought, wow, you know, from Buddhist teachings that I've been deeply inspired by, this is what that can be like if I don't do this work now. It's like, you know, coming to my end coming to my end. I don't want the hellish emergences of my undealt with work coming up on my deathbed. You know, I could feel that there was some sacred relevance with that breath work where, okay, hold your breath, and you're dealing with years of trauma, maybe even intergenerational. You know, if you go to different traditions, it's lifetimes. So yeah, I had definite deep introspective philosophical learnings as to like a near-death experience and coming that close to my breath and breath holding and overcoming asthma. So yeah, just a little bit of context.
The
answer.
The breathing context for my last 12 days with this type A flu my wife and I, you know, we practice Kundalini yoga, and we do the various approaches to breathing that you're talking about. And boy, you know, she just kept harping on those for me. She said, don't forget, you know, do the 10 breaths, you know, do the 5 and 5, do this. And really, you know, just really kept harping on me every time she would, you know, come over to deliver some tea or something, right? She'd say, did you do your breath work? Did you do your breath work, right? And so I totally resonate with that. And, you know, and of course, I go back to when I, it's kind of an interesting segue, but when I was in Houston doing my chemo, I just did three sessions, but I did a lot of work in between that allowed for a clean bill of health. One of the people there that picked me up from the airport is a former student of mine, Dr. Bram Duffy. And he and I have a book that comes out next week called Hypnotic Language for Emergency Medical Settings. Now, I had written a book, I don't think we talked about this last time, but in 1991, when I was an EMT firefighter, I wrote a book that Prentice Hall published called Patients Communication for First Responders. And it was banned. I was in Brisbane, Australia, speaking to 1,500 emergency room physicians, and they came up to me at lunch and said, Dr. Jacobs, we can't order your book. And I called up, and apparently some PhD MD had written an article for the Journal of Emergency Medical Association, GEMS, saying this should be used only by licensed physicians, not by paramedics. So the book was taken off the market. And so just about a year ago, this paramedic who was getting his doctorate with me at Fielding had come upon the old copy of the book and said, this has got to be republished. And I said, oh, it's yours, you know, just take it, you know, and it's all yours. Here's a couple of publishers that might look at it. So anyway, long story short, he said, oh, you got to be partnering with it. And so the, you know, the book will be coming out. And he was the one that gave me the virus, because he had been out in the field the day before. And while I was on the airplane getting sick, he was in the emergency rooms. And so all this kind of comes together. But one of the first things that I learned when I was, before I wrote that original book, and we did actually a video about it that people can see on YouTube, was a child who had asthma. And my partner Frank and I were coming down the hill with our bottle of oxygen, and this young 9-year-old girl was turning blue, and her parents were panicking and telling her that she's going to be okay, she can breathe, take a breath, et cetera, et cetera. And while Frank was bringing the oxygen bottle down, I just got down at face level with her. And I started breathing with her in a very desperate way. Oh, how hard this is to breathe, how difficult, how scary this is. And it was as if she looked at somebody that for the first time was getting what she felt. Mm-hmm. And by getting into that rapport, I started gradually taking the pace and changing the breathing. And she started following me. And within 30 seconds, the color came back. And that was the beginning of my research into this topic. So it's an interesting one.
Wow. I'm very, there's so much human curiosity with that experience. I have learned in my previous career, I was working as a physiotherapist in chronic pain treatment and management. And I similar type stories of maybe not in the clock time dramatic turnaround physiologically as you had with that child, but where the power of language, the power of empathizing with a human being, that the healing power that's in that. There was one experience with a lady where she, as I remember, her job was as a, she was a qualified clinical psychologist or psychotherapist. Like she, her day to day was, you know, working through other people's psychosomatic issues and, you know, life issues and mindset, et cetera, et cetera. But it was just so interesting, you know, in my work, I didn't do any physical examination very sparingly in the first session. It was all about the mind, all about, you know, listening to the person's perspective. And it came to the end of like maybe 80 minutes of her talking. She had a lot to say, just many years of pain. And I reflected it back to her. I was like, I lost count beyond maybe 20 references to fear or, you know, neighbors, next neighbors off it, like fear, afraid. It's like I lost count midway through. It's like fear, that word and its relatives dominated this entire conversation. And she burst into tears. And whatever the intuitive wisdom was for me at the time, I look back and I go, Mark, that was like that was craziness, because you know you're not meant to give patients false hope unless you have like really really grounded reasons to give it. She was like in a really catastrophic state, physically. Literally that day, I remember she couldn't squeeze a brand new tube of toothpaste that was open. She couldn't squeeze the toothpaste out. That was the level of pain inhibition in her upper limb.
No, you go ahead.
Just to bring it into landing, it's like she had such a relief. I think it's like my nervous system and some intuitive guidance inside of myself, out completely outside of my, you know, scientific training, college training, etc. I feel like my intuitive guidance just tapped base, that she had such a release. She burst into tears. Her whole posture and nervous system went completely relaxed. She was all tightened up coming in. She relaxed completely. And it was like what you said, it's like another human being was understanding her, was demonstrating, I get your experience. I get how much pain there must be in this experience of being like imprisoned by fear. She cried for multiple minutes and we said another few words. And then I said, hey, you know, just that kayak trip, it was during the conversation, that kayak trip that you've, you know, you've always dreamed of with your husband. It's like, I think he can book that for next summer at this point. It's like, do you mean that? It's like, yeah. And my intuition was on the money in the coming six or seven sessions. It was like, it was, you know, to my college training, it was a miraculous turnaround. You know, it was unexplained by my learnings. And yet when I start talking more and more with people like you, it's like there was nothing miraculous about it. It's just modern science hasn't widely accepted that. So I do meet you with, first of all, the human experience of modern science maybe sort of banning things and being like a little bit upset with radical teachings going out there. But I really do get the profundity of that experience that you had with that girl. And it's an amazing story, deeply inspired. Cool.
And you've explained the theory that I have behind it, which is that during times of stress, all creatures become hypersuggestible to the words and language communication of a perceived trusted authority figure. So think about that for a moment. During times of fear, all of us become hypersuggestible to a perceived trusted authority figure. Now, in a time of dictators and cruelty, that fear can be misguided by someone who uses this phenomenon of that I'm calling hypnosis, because that's the best word for it. They wouldn't let me use it in the Prentice Hall book, so but we definitely put it into this one. I insisted on it. And I actually learned that from a wild horse. I was training Mustangs, the BLM Mustangs, and I don't know if folks go to YouTube, put in the horse hypnotist, you can see me on a TV program with a wild horse getting on its back. But I was asked by a friend of mine, because I was doing endurance racing at the time, and one of my friends had a horse that wouldn't cross a creek, and said, "Forrest, you've been training all these BLM Mustangs, Bureau of Land Management Mustangs, and you know, doing so well. Would you, you know, take care of the candidate and get him to cross a creek?" So I was overconfident, thinking, "Yes, I've been doing this with wild horses. This will be a piece of cake with a, you know, a domestic horse." But I couldn't do it. It, whatever I was doing in terms of communication didn't work. And so intuitively, I walked the horse up higher in the creek and got him up about 6 feet above the embankment, got on him, and put all my weight on the right stirrup and dropped him into the creek. Got off, stood next to him in about a foot and a half of water, and you could see the white in his eyes. He was in fear. And I started communicating and singing and doing what I did, and that you'll see on the YouTube thing, and walked back up to where the creek crossing was, and he went right across it. And so I wrote down the fear hypothesis, this idea that during fear, we become hypersuggestible, and wound up sending, making a video up at the fire station. And Norman Cousins out of the UCLA psychoneuroimmunology, who wrote a book called Anatomy of an Illness, found out about it and got it published. So this is something that our book, Hypnosis at the emergency medical setting, it's a lifesaver. I mean, I've seen it save so many lives. And what you essentially did was you had a person in fear. You were able to move into that with this positive vision about the kayaking, and that which had symbolism of healing. And you know, your audience right now, even you know, just not having any expertise in emergency medicine or in hypnosis, if they came upon a crash where there's say a young lady was in a Volkswagen Bug and it was all mangled and you couldn't open the door, and the person walks up to it and looks inside and sees that the young lady is hemorrhaging. That person can simply say, "Listen, I've called the ambulance. Things are being made ready at the hospital. The worst is over. It's going to take about an hour before the team gets here to be able to open this up. And you're hemorrhaging right now. So I want you to listen to me carefully. When I count to three, I want you to go ahead and stop your bleeding. One, two, three." And within the first hour of trauma, there's a 90% chance that just like a yogi can control their blood pressure or bleeding, that hypnotic suggestion would work. And we have an acronym that we use, CREDIBLE, in the book, C-R-E-D, which stands for don't speak until you have confidence, build rapport, use a technique to build a minor expectation, and then give the directive. And then the directive has to create an image that's relatively believable, that will be taken literally, with just the right amount of enthusiasm. And so, you know, this book that's going to be coming out next week will save lives. And the idea of being able to understand the role of fear in setting us up. Now, of course, once you learn these things, then you learn to become move into courage and move into fearlessness, so that these kinds of results don't necessarily have to happen from somebody else because you do them yourself. But anyway, interesting segue, huh?
It's a beautiful segue. And as I've learned in any interaction with elder energy, get ready for the spontaneous ride. and pay attention, Mark. What I'm loving is the spontaneous shift in. I think it comes in. It can come in really potently for guys listening in. My super curiosity at this point, Four Arrows, is, you know, taking the wisdom of the book and what you're saying, like when somebody experiences, you know, an acute stress, that they become hyper-suggestible to perceived trusted authority figures. there's a question coming up in my mind, and is your whole life experience, you know, maybe the academic, your books, your drawing on, man, I'm not even going to start listing the level of experience you have, but a lot of guys are meeting their wives. You know, the podcast here, it's Be the Husband She Brags About. A lot of guys are really tuning into that title. You know, the title hooks them, they get curious. For the majority of the guys listening in, it's because there's a moment of stress. There's a lot of stress in their marriage. And the crux of this issue is very often their wives aren't perceiving them as the trusted authority figure. So they're, most guys are saying, it's like, if I use those terms, it's like, oh, do you ever come across as being hyper-suggestible to your wife? It's like, fuck no. Most of them are going to go, hyper-suggestible is the polar opposite end. It's like, my wife has stopped listening to me. She doesn't, like most guys suggest, like they report, you know, their wives don't have a lot of trust with them at all in their leadership, et cetera, et cetera. So maybe playing on the same back, and maybe it's leaning into your wisdom of, you know, the suggestibility, the powerful use of language. But if, what words of wisdom do you have from your life experience of husbands listening in, and there's a lot of stress there? Their wives would love to be led out of a certain situation, you know, a marriage turnaround, et cetera, et cetera. But the guys are starting on, you know, they're on thin ice. They don't maybe have that level of confidence or the rapport and the expectation, the directive, you know, from the cred.
That's a great question. It's a great question. You know, and we deal with it when we're dealing with paramedics in the field who don't have that confidence in actuality. I would say that it's something that allows you to look at an amazing possibility for the transformation to a sense of confidence. And that is that if the husband is feeling that, wow, I don't have this position of respect from my wife, that would come close to them seeing me as a trusted authority figure. I don't come close to that. The thing for them to do is to become so empathetic, so aware of their other partner and that partner's fears, so that at some point in time, when they are in an argument or they see some yelling or whatever manifestation, if there's an intuition, instead of being self-centered about, is this my fault, etc., to really look at, wow, what is my wife afraid of? What is the situation here? And if one is looking for that, you know, it doesn't take many weeks before a situation comes up where somebody doesn't manifest a fear. And when that fear comes up, if they come in with this credible mnemonic, this compassion, this confidence, this rapport, this building an expectation, and this offering a directive, bingo. They will have accomplished two things. They will have moved into a place where they are showing and manifesting their being a trusted authority figure, because it will work. It will work. That empathy, that sense of understanding that one, that the husband would give in the throes of the wife's fear, recognizing that fear and giving that positive affirmation, that would, whatever it would be, that would be the most appropriate, you know, like yours. Yeah, and I know, honey, that this is really difficult. I know how frightened you are, but by golly, we're going to be out on that kayak next week, you know? And so it's an opportunity to understanding this phenomenon. You know, and not only should help us prevent ourselves from listening to people who are shouldn't be trusted, but it allows us to get into a place where we understand that people have that phenomenon happening all the time, that their fears are putting them into a state of hypersuggestibility. And if they're not listening to somebody saying something with compassion that's positive and right on, then they're going to be listening to old programs and are people that are saying the wrong thing.
I'm really hearing you on the empathy and the power of overcoming, you know, your own self-centered perspective of, oh, she doesn't trust me, oh, she puts me down. There's just a ton of guys speak with those reports, and like myself, I put my hand up energetically going, first 12 years of marriage, I was so self-centered. I thought it was a nice guy, but it was ultimately exceptionally self-centered, always thinking of my own pitfalls, and she was out to get me and the world was out to get me. So empathy, that reframe, and repeatedly, I love the context there, you know, what is she afraid of? I mean, ask that with focus and consistency over a number of weeks, you know, you're going to get that rapport. I'd love to hear your wisdom and insights on the first pillar of that 4 hours, confidence, because like a lack of confidence is like one of these golden threads in, I don't know, it feels like 90% of conversations I'm having with guys around the world, be the husband or not. And it's like there's this large scale lack of confidence in men. What advice would you have with a guy to the guys listening in where they just don't know how to access a core of confidence?
Well, you know, one of the things that that Norman Cousins did at UCLA's psychoneuroimmunology, when he got excited about the little video I had put together, he had professional actors and actresses coming in, and he would ask them to act afraid or act confident. And then they would measure white blood cell counts and things like that. And so, you know, when I was first teaching paramedics this back before the book was banned, you know, I would say, look, you know, before you come onto the scene, look at your fears. You don't know what you're going to see when you got a call for somebody that's down or a heart attack or an overdose, whatever it is. You know, when you come to an emergency scene, you know, no matter how macho a firefighter may think he is, boy, you're afraid. You don't know, what am I going to come upon? Am I going to be able to handle it? Am I going to be, you know, able to do anything that's going to be useful? And so that lack of confidence is in the most experienced of medics. And so I would tell, become an actor. You know, just become an actor. You take and just imagine yourself being as confident as, you know, whatever figure in your life you look at as a model for that. And you take that confidence, because that confidence is going to help save a life. Right. So there's the rationale for it. If you feel like it's fake, that confidence is going to save a life. And so just one starting place. I mean, there's others that maybe we could talk about, but that's what Norman Cousins did. And that's why he was so excited about the real time phenomenon that I was doing during that first hour of trauma, when people are a fear because of a life-threatening or a painful situation. So he didn't have to, you know, he said, wow, you don't have to go out and hire actors and actresses, right? So, you know, I think that might just be a start. Is, look, you learn to pretend to be confident, you know, and do it for the right reason, which is that you're gonna be able to help somebody, and that what's going on with your wife right now ultimately is fear. It's not resentment or anger about something else. It's basically a fear.
I'm curious, is Norman Cousins, because his name is ringing a bell, was he the author or researcher behind the as if principle, act as if? It just, it sounds, it's ringing my bell with previous readings from years ago.
Yeah, he's a pretty I don't know, he's not with us anymore, I'm sure, but he was very, very famous. His book sold, The Anatomy of an Illness, I think sold a million copies. And he was very instrumental in cancer healing with visualization and things like that. So,
okay. Yeah. Whether it was Norman's beautiful work or not, it's what you're saying there about, you know, these paramedics approaching the scene of an accident and not knowing what's going to come, you know, that to acknowledge, first of all, I'm just touching base. I'm like, yeah, it's so important to acknowledge your own fears, the uncertainty of what you're going to meet. But there's that choice. It's like, how are you going to show up and just act? There's the as if principle, whatever the author, I can't quote exactly, but it sounds very much exactly what you're saying there. 4 hours, which is just, you know, when you have an important thing to go into, you're going to be more influential in a positive way for everybody involved if you bring confidence. So you have a choice there to act as if you're confident, just access that role. How would you play that? So yeah, it is a beautiful one, because I'm always looking for here is, you know, conversations can go into deep philosophy. And deep philosophy is beautiful. I love going there. But tangible tools, tangible perspectives that guys can link in and go, okay, cool. Next conversation with my wife, we're nearing divorce or things are on the rocks. We have been sleeping in separate bedrooms for like 8-9 months, et cetera, et cetera. There's lots of situations out there that does take quite a step up in guys accessing confidence that's a real tangible approach and a tool. What if you can just act as if you are, like you saying, like you will as improve the results as if.
Yeah, as if. No, that's exactly what Norman's, all of his original work was done, but with people acting and acting as if. Now, that said, indigenous cultures, which is, you know, my main shtick, they understood this deeply without knowing the technical term hypnosis and you know, brainwave frequency and all of that kind of stuff. They understood that if you were going to be at your best, you could not do it with willful determination, with cognitive thinking. You had to enter into a trance. Trance-based learning was automatic with our pre-contact cultures. And ceremony is an example of it. Ceremony is going into a lower brainwave frequency because of whatever the situation of the ceremony is, having intentionality. And so building confidence and gaining confidence is a really a chore that calls for learning how to do self-hypnosis. All hypnosis ultimately is self-hypnosis. I quit my practice when I realized that. Instead of charging people all this money, you know, and making them think I'm the only one that can help them quit smoking or overcome their fear. And had a lot of success with it, but until I realized, wait a minute, I can teach people how to do this. And so this idea of self-hypnosis is really, I think, a missing link. I wrote a book called The Bum's Rush, The Selling of Environmental Backlash, Phrases and Fallacies of Rush Limbaugh in 1994, showing that his efforts to get people not to believe that there was any kind of climate change or any environmental problems was a beautiful example of hypnosis. And so in this book, which I think people can get copies for like $2 now on Amazon, I list all these strategies, like a double bind. You know, would you be more comfortable with your arm at your side, or would you be more comfortable with your arm here, right? And then someone's going to, in a light chance, will choose a double bind all the time and choose one or the other. Well, people like Rush Limbaugh and Donald Trump and, well, anybody, positive or negative, I'm just talking about negatives here, they can use these these strategies. And once you understand them and you recognize them, then first of all, you can avoid being hypnotized by them. But secondly, you can use self-hypnosis to say, okay, I'm going to get more confidence. There has not been a gold medal athlete in the Olympics in the last 45 years that has not hired a sports psychologist to teach them how to visualize and to teach them how to do self-hypnosis. Natalie Mulhausen is a 27-year-old lady that came to me about 5 years ago. She was 265th in the world. And now she's the world champion in fencing from Brazil. And wow. So it was from teaching her, you know, this phenomenon. I mean, I'll tell you a fun story that because how it connects to fear. I was scheduled to do a hypnosis session with her when we were in Cuba for the North American Championship. And she was very frightened about the Chinese person that she had drawn. And I said, well, we're going to have to do some hypnosis, you know. And of course, at that time, I wasn't teaching it to her. It's easier to have someone do it for you, but ultimately, you want to learn to do it yourself. And she was sort of halfway to having that confidence. And so I was on the sixth floor of this old rickety hotel in Cuba. And she was next door with her father and a photographer that was going to be supposedly recording the hypnosis session, which I didn't want to have happen. I didn't want the distraction. And so I thought, what can I do to get her riled? And I looked out the window, and there was about an 8-inch wide piece of metal that was joining my window on the sixth floor to the room next door where her and her father had. And so I opened the window and I scooted over and I got to the window and knocked on their window. Well, she was facing the window and her dad's back was towards me. And she looked up and saw me and screamed. And of course, he always tells the story, wow, I thought there must be Godzilla must have been behind me. You know, what could have been up six floors? Right? Yeah. And he slowly turned around and went, oh, my God. And he came over and opened the window. And I just sort of stayed out there. And I said, Natalie, let's do our hypnosis out here today. Well, she was used to me doing a lot of crazy things with her, with paddling and white water and things like that to get her into that state. And so she thought, well, you know, he's not fooling me. And as soon as I did that, she said, okay, I'm canceling my reporter. I'm ready, you know. And it was just one of those fun things, right? But the ultimate thing that I really want to get across here is that this, you know, you can just get yourself a paper clip and a piece of dental floss, and you just take and hold it and with your elbow on the table, and just hold it between your finger and thumb and imagine it going in a circle. Just really believe in imagining it. Now, if you're thinking cognitively, it won't happen. If it starts to move and then you went, wow, what happened there? Did somebody blow? Did the wind blow? Or what is that? It'll stop. But if you believe in seeing that image of it going around, the ideomotor neurons in your fingertips will actually cause that light weight, that pendulum, to go in a circle. It's a Ouija board effect, if you will. Mm-hmm. And if you realize that, all that's telling you is that you have just entered into a light trance, significant enough for, like, I had my appendix taken out with self-hypnosis. And so you're in this light trance. If you keep that pendulum going, that means you're still in that ideomotor neuron phenomenon, that those are sufficient to move this thing. And you have a predetermined affirmation, like whatever it could be. You know, you could think of a million things. You know, I'm going to be confident when I speak to my wife, whatever. If you then begin to imagine that while you double task, keeping the pendulum going, That's like paying somebody $300 an hour to hypnotize them. All right. And so that's how simple that this is. And we've known this for, you know, again, most of human history. This is why ceremonies were so crucial in maximizing hunting and generosity and all those kinds of things. So pretty important lesson, I think.
It bamboozles my mind. I love the whole mind, body, spirit connection and, you know, stories like that. And then the results, I mean, she went from what, 200 and whatever in the world to number one. And like, I love the power of the mind and honing in. You know, the guys have gotten used to me, and the guys are following me, is I do guest episodes once per week, but, you know, once a week I do a solo episode, which very often I have like half a page of notes in front of me, but I can speak for like, sometimes I can go for an hour and 20 minutes solo. I'm just, you know, going off inspiration, what's coming up, going there. And the audience is exponentially increasing. So I'm taking that as good feedback that guys like what they're hearing. It mightn't have been to that level of trance awareness. But part of my process with that 4 hours was for years now, I don't do it anymore because I'm in the lived reality of what I was manifesting back then. But before my days of recording the podcast, I'd just get myself in the sitting room. We had in our previous house a yoga room. It was a big room and there's mirrors there. And I could just get caught in a riff. Like my wife used to sort of wonder, like in the beginning when I was a bit embarrassed, actually very embarrassed by it, I was talking to myself. But what I was doing was I just start speaking to a topic. And I just go with what came out in front of me. And I was really, again, it's like that act as if principle. But I was speaking like I'm a teacher and I was imagining there's like 500 guys in front of me. There's a full audience. There's 1,000, like there's a packed room. And I've just got to keep speaking. I've got to keep them engaged and just trust what was coming through me. In the end, like I owned up to my wife. She come in a couple of times sort of like, what are you doing? Because I wasn't doing it out loud, but I thought it was whispering. She was actually hearing this muttering. She thought at times I was on these secret phone calls. But in the end, I was like, hey, look, baby, this is actually what I'm doing. I'm just scared of public speaking. I'm wanting to do this. I will be doing it in future, etc. I had no career in coaching or no podcast. I had no audience at that point. But I did that. I lost count of the amount of times. It was like a daily phenomenon. It wasn't an exact set ritual, but I was doing it all the time anyway. And here I am, you know, it's like from a nervous system from my family of origin, where none of your authentic expression was welcome. You know, there was a lot of snide humor and so much smiles and laughter, but there were put downs. I definitely experienced those put downs of my authentic truth, where I was never ever feeling emotionally safe to really truly express myself, you know, verbally or to sing or anything that was outside the accepted norm. To now, it's like, you know, it's like I'm 120 episodes in, and still is a practice to do it to make sure I bring my best, but my nervous system is definitely coming from an entirely different identity, which I suppose is like self-hypnosis in a way. Does that make sense as self-hypnosis?
Well, it is. I mean, it is. And I think we've got to get to a place where we start calling it. I know there's such fear about the word hypnosis from Hollywood, from the religions. All Abrahamic religions say it's of the devil. We've really got to get past that, you know. And yeah, there's 77 different words that people use for visualization to avoid it. But if you want to study the literature, well, wait a minute, is hypnosis real? You know, if you want to look at pain management, look at placebo, look at, you know, somebody can with Google get enough sense of credibility. Hey, this hypnosis really works, and the self-hypnosis really works. And you use the word yourself, imagination. That's all hypnosis is believing deeply in an image while you're in a lower brainwave frequency. That's pretty much the best definition that one can give with this mysterious phenomena. But we know it's a real phenomenon. We know now that that from Nature magazine, who required this to be done three times before they would publish it, that if you hypnotize somebody and then you show them red, yellow, blue cards, that we know that the brain actually has a particular part in it that will see blue or red. That if you hypnotize them to see a yellow card as red, rapidly, whenever they see that yellow card, they'll say it's red. And but now we know from MRIs that the brain actually sees the wrong color. This is how powerful that this phenomenon is, right? And so, you know, by practicing it, you know, Einstein said imagination is more powerful than knowledge. And you take a 2x4 and put it on the ground and say, can you walk across that? And somebody walks across it, raise it 1,000 feet in the air and bring them up and say, now do it. You know, and their imagined possibility of falling would either keep them from doing it, or if you give them enough money, they'd probably go out and fall, right? Because of that imagined possibility. So I think yeah, this idea the time has finally come for my book on emergency hypnosis in medical settings. I think we've got to look at how we can begin to recognize that we are hypnotizing ourselves to do negative things all the time, mostly early childhood images, because that's during the first 5 years you are in a state of hypnosis. You can learn 10 languages, right? And so many of our problems, I'd say 80% of our problems, come from the incorrect hypnotic suggestions during the first 5 years of life. But we can now come back and put ourselves into a light trance very simply, and we can begin to imagine how we want to be. And I think it's a tool that we really want to start promoting.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And actually, for guys listening in, a lot of times in the discovery calls, like guys when they reach out to me and in one-on-one coaching or the groups, I mean, not per se, again, well, actually, I think you're supporting me break my ignorance on this topic, because I was about to, you know, asterisk again, oh, maybe it's not hypnosis, but going with your broadening perspective, I am actually using tons of tools that are directly linked with hypnosis of the mind, because all of the approach is supporting men believe that they can do it. Ultimately, that's it. It's like, you can do it, man. You know, I love you, I accept you, you know. That reference of, hey, you know, you had a hood over your head for your first 20 years of marriage. That's okay. You were like, you know, you grew up in a profoundly sick society that was disconnection based, pretty much in all the pillars of society. Man, that's not on you, that's on society. But it's on you now that the hood is off your head and you can do it. And every guy reaffirms every other guy's efforts. And now there's this magical thing happening. And it is self-hypnosis and collective group hypnosis, where we're just going to feed impulses to every man individually and collectively of, you can do it, you are doing it. That was not a mini breakthrough, that was a major breakthrough. So his confidence skyrockets, and as you say, it's like the belief in the imagination can now contain a happy marriage is a possibility. My, you know, making love with my wife, even though I've been kicked out of the bedroom for 12, you know, for 12 months, etc., it is a possibility. So yeah, I'm loving your grounded sticking with a point that we need to bring this out from the doldrums, out from the shadows of society, and speak to it. Four arrows.
Well, keep in mind that when we spoke last, we mentioned briefly my near-death experience on the Rio Uric and the cat and the fawn. That's what cat fawn is. Just to remind you and to remind your readers, cat is concentration activated transformation. It's just another word for hypnosis. And fawn are four of the worldview precepts of the 40 that I've been invited to speak at the United Nations September 28th. And I'm very excited about that. And I'm going to be speaking about indigenous worldview to the 78th General Assembly.
Wow.
And so I'm very excited about that. But that this fawn idea is fear, authority, words, nature, F-A-W-N. And that if we understand what is it that I'm afraid of from my early childhood or from, you know, some experience that happened to me that relates to my marriage, on whose authority do I have that fear? There's something my dad said, something that happened to me in a trauma. Fear, authority, words. What words do I say to myself? And are they honest? Are they accurate? And nature. In what ways have I not, or have I learned, or can I learn from witnessing the animals, the insects, the trees? And so these four ideas of fear, authority, words, and nature, if we look at whatever problems that we're having in our relationships, what are the fears? On whose authority do they come from? What words? I mean, words are so powerful. You know, I had a guy from San Francisco that he called me up and he said he wanted to come and see me because he sweated profusely whenever he went into a meeting. He was, he had like four sports coats. He'd been to all kinds of doctors, and he wanted to come over to Marin County to have me hypnotize him. I said, well, what do you say to yourself before you go to the meeting? I said, okay. I said, I'll schedule you for next week. But I said, in the meantime, instead of saying I have to, say I want to and see what happens. He called and canceled the meeting and said, well, you must have hypnotized me on the phone. I haven't sweat in four meetings, right? So this is how powerful words are. So fear, authority, words, and then nature being one that is a little more tricky to deal with. But mm-hmm. then once you get and say, I see where I'm coming from, and it's been a wrong-headed place. But you're not going to change it with willful determination because it's a hypnotic program. That's mm-hmm. where you get into CAT, the mountain lion, that crossed our sleeping bags in the cave, right? Mm-hmm. Concentration, activated transformation, hypnosis is just another word for it. Yeah. So you have to be able to say, okay, I've got to imagine that deeply to be able to do it. And then have an in vivo exposure. What does that mean? That means I'm going to go talk to my wife. You know, I'm going to go do this. I'm going to practice and test this and reify it. Right. Yeah. So I don't mean to make this sound overly simple, but by golly, it's a lot easier than not doing it.
Well, it's a lot easier than the hypnotized story that we were told growing up, that it's all complex. And there's one bit of language that I hear a lot today, which is sort of, there's people will often, in my observation listening, is they start with a lament on the world, and then it's like this, oh, but sure, what can you do? It's like this, it's like, wow, well, there's a ton that you can do. But like when you talk from about negative hypnotic use of words and a belief system, it's like, oh, but sure, what can you do? And there's a minimizing and normalizing of stagnancy of you're feeling of a feeling of impotence, that you've no capacity to affect any change. So it's the polar opposite that you're implementing. And I wanted to, you mentioned nature there, I wanted to live in person for hours. Thank you deeply for Restoring the Kinship Worldview, the book. It was the original book, guys. I'll have it in the podcast description, the link to it. But I've got so much more connected with nature since my conversation with you and from reading your book. When you're talking about nature there and like just leaning in and learning from nature, I was getting so much of my wisdom from books and podcasts and listening to other people. It was very academic, mentally oriented. Reading your book and speaking with you, I started being way more inspired being in nature and seeking solitude time in nature. And since that call, and that habit has continued to today, and it's deepening now. But you know, some examples of where I was moved beyond words. On our, we have 8 horses, as we've spoken to before. We've 8 horses, and my wife is big into them. And where we bring, when we muck out the stables and we bring the horse manure, there's a big compost pile. And nettle plants grow in it quite vigorously every year. And there's, in the time of year, there's these particular, I don't know, the moths or butterfly, but they lay their eggs on the nettle plants. And then the caterpillars grow. And I'm captivated. Ever since speaking with you, I look at them and it's spellbinding. It's like my nervous system can't comprehend.
The
level of drive. I literally have spent, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes, which for me, you know, a lot of my day is scheduled, homeschooling and work, business, animals, time with my queen, etc. There's a lot of stuff going on. 10 or 15 minutes is like quite a chunk of time for spontaneous introspection, or, you know, I've just been bamboozled. I've come down like a child at Christmas to my queen and gone, have you ever stopped with the caterpillars? And she's looked at me going, boy, you're changing as a man. It's like you used to never. So I wanted to share that with you.
Thank you.
That's a real heart opening, you know, a distinct shift from reading your book and wisdom, but it's bringing so much depth to my life. And
well,
literally,
thank you for sharing that. And I got a big smile on my face. Yeah, just as evidence that I'm starting to feel better. Yesterday, I thought, is there a book that I can write to get this point across? And I called it 365 Days of Thank You. And I start out day one with the ant. And then, you know, my plan was to do 365 plants or creatures in nature, you know, other than human or greater than human, and then just have a paragraph of giving thanks for what they do, right? Yeah. And so your story is so important, and even when people are in places where there are very few opportunities for being outside of concrete and glass, some of those findings are as important, or even more so than those that we would find in a more natural environment, like the weeds coming up through the concrete sidewalk. What an amazing thing that is to contemplate, you know, that kind of stuff.
Four arrows. First of all, you've been speaking so beautifully to empathy. I want to touch base with you, brother. I know we like maybe clock time, but how are you feeling? Because I know with the flu and that, are you good for another 10 minutes here, or do you want to come into landing now?
Well, let's start bringing in the landing. I'm beginning to feel a little bit dizzy and just a little bit with my voice is almost ready to cough. So I think we've covered so much material that I think that it might be good for people to take a breath and settle into it. Maybe I'll close with something that just came to my mind, is that I don't want people to think that they really have to have a doctoral degree in psychology or hypnosis and all this. And I'll just tell the brief story about my appendectomy. I was working for a plastic surgeon in San Francisco, doing hypnosis for people who could not do anesthesia. And then I was also a firefighter at the same time, working my way through my doctoral degree. And I wound up with appendicitis and went into the Kaiser Hospital. And I was at Kaiser Hospital in the emergency room, and they said, yeah, we got to take your appendix out. So they wheeled me into the operating room. Dr. Trevor Hughes was the anesthesiologist. And I said to him, I said, look, I'm Dr. Jacobs. I said, I work for Dr. Emery and doing anesthesia with hypnosis. I would like to try it on myself to see what my patients experience. Kind of hoping he would say no, but he didn't. And he said, you know, I'm a student of this myself. I would love to do it, but let me hook you up so that if you feel any pain, you give me the thumbs up. And I went, please do, please do. And he put guitar music on. And so at that time, I had a 30-minute, you know, routine that I had learned, that Dr. Joseph Barber's rapid induction analgesia. And that's what I had used on my patients. That was my, you know, my focus of how to do it. Well, the doctor walks in, the physician, the surgeon, and says, how come this guy isn't under? You know, and Dr. Hughes explained it. And he said, well, it isn't going to hurt me. And he went right for the scalpel. And now I'm like 5 minutes into a 30-minute, you know, walking down the stairs and all the kind of stuff to induce this rapid induction analgesia script. And I'm thinking, in 2 minutes, you know, or 30 seconds, he's going to be cutting me. What am I going to do? And I was about to say, hey, you know, turn on the juice. Because I had, you know, that my only confidence was in this routine that I had done, that had proven itself with a lot of patients. But all of a sudden, it came to my mind a guy named Don Buck, who was a martial artist and also a bodybuilder that I knew and had done an article on him to see, because he could knock a bull out. He did it in Japan. He knocked a bull out in a bull ring, and he could take a dime, an American dime, and bend it and bend it and bend it and bend it until he could actually tear it in half. Unbelievable kinds of skills. And I thought, this has got to be some kind of hypnosis, but he didn't know anything about hypnosis. Now, I won't go into that long story, but he just said, I just do it. And so I thought, well, that's what I'm going to do. So I jumped to the bottom punchline, which was nothing to bother. And right as I did it, nothing to bother, I felt this sharp, searing pain. And, you know, it was the scalpel going into my skin. And the sharper the pain, the more I said nothing to bother. And then it went into the inner oblique muscle group, which is a kind of pain that I've never had before. And again, nothing to bother. Well, the punchline of my story is this. I felt the cut going vertical up and down, because I had only seen one appendectomy scar, and I had seen it a lot in my father when I'd be on his belly. And in the old days, that's how they did it. But after the operation, I was only in the hospital for a day, but nurses and everybody were coming up to the room saying, this is the guy who did this with hypnosis. And when the nurse came over and lifted up the bandage, I saw that the cut was horizontal. Instead of vertical, it was going in the opposite direction. And I was blown away. But the imagination of what that was greater than the reality, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of pieces to that story that I think people can resonate with. Not that they're going to go, oh my God, I want to do that, but in terms of the natural capabilities that this relates to, and not the skill set per se. So, all right, my friend.
Four arrows. It's been an honor and a privilege a second time to have you on, and I know in some ways, you know, it makes no difference to you as a person, but there's a particular sort of nerdy geek part of me going, I've just had a UN General Assembly guest speaker on my humble podcast. So it is just you're an impressive man. I'm deeply impressed by your open-heartedness, your courage, again, under the scalpel, literally. And just what you come to represent for me, and I hope guys listening in, is just that elder energy, that embodied spiritual wisdom that is inarguably yours and has been tested, and you've carved out a character from immense challenges in life. And I'm deeply inspired by that. And it's so beautiful for me that our community of guys listening in have had access to that for this sacred second time. So thank you, my friend.
And thank you for your good work.
Thank you to Four Arrows coming in today. And guys, what a man. And as always, lean into the wisdom as much as you can of the beauty that that he brought to this call in ending with the mantra of our movement. Better husbands today, better world tomorrow. Go have an amazing kingly day. And before you go, kingly brothers, I'm so happy to let you know that Heroic Husbands Men's Circles waiting list is now live. Online meetings supporting you up level to hero husband status. Go from fearing your best will never be good enough to becoming the competent and confident husband she brags about. Save years of needless guesswork and confidence eroding disconnection. Click on the link in the podcast description to take your first simple step to becoming the marriage-transforming hero of your relationship. Check it out now.